Well, I think we can get started. Good morning to you all. Let me start by introducing myself. I'm Kemal Kirişçi, the Senior Tusayat Fellow at Brookings and also running the Turkey project there. And today's conference has to be very close and dear to my heart. As in the last, just before I retired from Boğaziçi University, I had been for almost a decade a Jean Monnet professor, and I remain loyal to his legacy and to his project. So I suspect the questions that I will fire at our participants here are probably going to be somewhat biased. And I'm also delighted that I've been invited to be the moderator this morning. Before I introduce you to the speakers and the panelists, let me say that I still think these are interesting times in terms of EU-Turkish relations, not necessarily for the reasons that I think we'll be discussing this morning, but last September, was the 60th anniversary of the Ankara Agreement of 1963, the very agreement that had set Turkey on this path. It ought not to be taken lightly. But then we must also not forget that the Ottoman Empire was part of this path from an earlier time, the Treaty of Paris that was signed back in the mid-19th century on the heels of the Crimean War. So Turkey's experience with institutional involvement in Europe is a very long-lasting one. And I do believe and think that as we get involved in today's discussion, that ought to remain in the background, that legacy. And it is, I believe, a very important one. Let me very briefly introduce you to the speakers. Nilgün Arısan Eral is a very old friend who is soaked, for good or bad, in EU-Turkish affairs. I'll keep it brief. For many, many years, she actually worked with what was then called the EU General Secretariat. For some reason, I preferred that title to the current Minister of Ministry of EU Relations. The second speaker will be Rana Deep Islam, sitting right next to me. He has been associated with IIGS for some time and is currently the project manager of Stiftung Mercator in Germany and has a long experience in observing German politics from the perspective of the EU and EU-Turkish relations. Hmm. And I think I need not say that Germany, both in the 19th century, then Prussia, and subsequently Germany, throughout the 20th century, has always been a very important country for Turkey and Turkey's European vocation. Third speaker is going to be Joshua Walker. Josh is a good friend of us as well as of Turkey, with deep involvement in Turkish affairs, familiarity with it as well, and familiarity with the Ottoman Empire, not to mention the Russian and Japanese empires as well. He's currently at the German Marshall Fund of the U.S., but I believe you do also have another engagement, which was
APCO Worldwide.
Yeah, okay, thanks. And finally, Ambassador Ross Wilson, with field experience in Turkey, of course, in the United States as well. And with Ross, we feel we share a fascination with getting Turkey into the transatlantic trade and partnership investment, a challenge, and there might be a little opportunity here to talk about it as well. Ambassador Wilson is currently with the Atlantic Council of the United States. I think what I was asked by the organizers is to direct some questions to the panelists and try to get a conversation going here before we turn to you all, the participants here. Nilgün, I think I'll follow the order in the program here and start with you. I was encouraged to ask a particular question. I mean no offense to the organizers, but a question that I found a little bit passé. You know, what are the cons and pros of Turkey's membership to the European Union? Let that sit in the background, and maybe all the panelists in one way or the other could bring their perspective on it. But with you, Nilgün, I'd like to reflect on the very recent developments. I don't know if you will agree with me and participants here. I have this gut feeling down here, and I have some evidence for it from behind closed doors, that the Turkish government, I won't name names, you know, it might get me into trouble, the Turkish government recognizes that things have gone utterly haywire in as far as Turkey's Middle East and Syria policy specifically goes. I am part of a project called Syrian Displacement Crisis at Brookings, and I've just come back from Turkey, and I was struck by how bureaucrats from the lowest level to the level of governor, and I will not mention which governor, make the following remark, that this crisis is partly of Turkey's making as well. Business people are somewhat uncomfortable with the developments, and I follow trade statistics for Turkey very closely, and I've been struck the way in which, in spite of the economic difficulties in the EU, Turkish EU trade is picking up compared to the rest of the world and other regions. And it was only a less than a year ago that some leading ministers and MPs in Turkey used to talk in a somewhat denigrating fashion about the EU. I have this, Nilgün, feeling that this is changing, and the government is, if I dare you use the word, trying to cozy up with the EU. Can we read the recent trip by the Prime Minister to Brussels and then to Berlin from that perspective, or did those visits had more to do with domestic politics and coming elections, Nilgün?
Thank you, Kemal. I'll start by asking you, you are right, I mean, we are living interesting times in Turkey-EU relations, but I hope the interesting times you refer to are not the interesting times in, like, in the Chinese curse. I hope not. May you live interesting times. Well, the recent top-level visits, let's say, Prime Minister's visit to Brussels and then François Hollande's visit to Turkey and then Prime Minister's visit to Berlin, they all were taught as crowning the recent rapprochement between Turkey and the EU. It started this autumn after the harsh exchange of harsh statements last May during the Gezi Park protest. The relations started to smooth up a bit starting from autumn on. I mean, the progress report published for Turkey by the EU had a moderate tone, although it warned Turkey about the failures in having a pluralistic participatory democracy and about the state of the fundamental rights, but the tone of the criticisms were very moderate, and it tried to highlight the even minor steps of reform. Afterwards, after 3 years, a chapter was opened in the stalling accession negotiations, chapter on regional policy, which is very important for Turkey. And finally, in mid-December, a visa dialogue started between Turkey and the EU that is thought to end up with a visa-free regime between Turkey and the EU, but we don't know what would happen. So the Prime Minister's visit to Brussels came after all these. When it was planned before mid-December, the expectation was that Prime Minister will think about, will talk about giving a new momentum to the accession negotiations, etc. But the main topic that was discussed there, the Prime Minister tried to explain the recent corruption probe in Turkey, referring to the existence of parallel state, the attempt of a coup, describing what has happened as a coup attempt towards the government. I mean, it went smoothly in the sense that there was no public discussion. But behind the closed doors, we know that both the president of the Commission, president of the EU Council, and president of European Parliament drew the attention of the Turkish government to the need for a transparent and impartial judiciary process and to the need to continue to the corruption investigations in a very transparent way. And they emphasized the importance of the rule of law. Mind you, European Union changed its enlargement strategy back in 2012. If you look at the enlargement strategy of the European Union in 2012, you'll see that there's a new emphasis on rule of law. Rule of law became the main pillar of the Copenhagen political criteria. I mean, this is due to the failures of the new member states, Bulgaria, Romania, and due to a certain extent, Hungary. Their failures pushed the European Union to put the rule of law to the center of the Copenhagen criteria. So the European Union warned all these three presidents, but I should also say that they're both outgoing presidents. Their term will come to an end in May, in a few months. They all warned Prime Minister regarding the importance of having an impartial judiciary, having the rule of law, the importance of the separation of powers. And he paid respect to the EU norms in this sense when he was there. And then came François Hollande's visit. What is the expectation of François Hollande's visit? Since Sarkozy's term, since 2007, France has been blocking five chapters just because of these chapters' direct bearing on membership. France removed its blockage from only one chapter that was opened, regional policy. What was expected from François Hollande was to remove the blockage from the other chapters. That doesn't mean that those chapters will be opened. Then the court will be in Turkey's, the ball will be on Turkey's court. But he didn't refer to any of these chapters, blocked chapters. I think the main objective also of his visit was to improve bilateral economic relations between Turkey and France. And like they did in Brussels, like the presidents of three important EU institutions, he touched upon the necessity to open two chapters, chapter 23 and 24. Chapter 23 is judiciary and fundamental rights, and chapter 24 is justice and freedom and security. These are very important for the state of democracy in Turkey. He referred to the importance of opening these chapters. And then came the visit of our prime minister to Germany. People, and including me, both his visit to Brussels and both his visit to Berlin, in his two visits, the consideration regarding domestic politics play a crucial role. In Brussels, although the EU-Turkish relations are not at their best of times, still 44% of Turkish people believe that EU accession would be a good thing for Turkey. This appeared in the GMF's German Marshall Fund's Transatlantic Trends. And he wanted to give the signal to the domestic audience and to Brussels that, I mean, our relations are in track. They go on. Regarding his visit to Germany, definitely domestic policy considerations play a crucial role there, because from this year on, Turks in German will vote in the presidential elections and then in the parliamentary elections next year. So that played a crucial role. It was presented as if it went very smoothly. The reason it is presented like that, there is no exchange of harsh statements. There is no fight in front of the public. But even I don't regard that that visit turned out to be very well. I'm looking from Turkish-EU relations point of view, because Angela Merkel she said that she's not still very sure about the end of the negotiations. The negotiations are open-ended, but like Holland, she also emphasized the importance of opening these two chapters that I just mentioned. What I try to question here, what that open-ended means? Does it mean the negotiations will remain open-ended as long as Turkey doesn't fulfill the membership conditions? I have all the respect for such an approach. But does this mean that civilizational compatibility questions would play a role in the eventual decision of the Germany to take Turkey as a full member? With the second approach, unfortunately, EU loses all its leverage on Turkey. And what I cannot understand, there's one more thing I cannot understand in the approach of two presidents, President François Hollande and Chancellor Angela Merkel. They keep referring to the importance of opening chapter 23 and 24. Yes, it is very important. Turkish Prime Minister also believes in the, at least he seems to believe in the importance of opening of these chapters. One member state, Cyprus, is blocking these two chapters. So I'm not convinced that two important founder members of the EU, France and Germany, cannot convince Cyprus to remove its blockage on these two important chapters. So some people refer to these two visits of the Prime Minister to Brussels and to Germany as dialogue of the deafs. I'm more inclined to that approach regarding the, because there is no concrete result coming out of these visits when you look at from the viewpoint of Turkish-EU relations. Shall I continue?
Before I turn over to Rana and try to look at this from the German perspective, I had one additional very quick question. I have this feeling, this sense that Angela Merkel did not put the emphasis on privileged partnership as much as she would have done a few years back. What do we make of it? And Rana, be ready. I think the question will be directed to you too. So
Rana would correct me if I'm wrong, but it is no more referred to as privileged partnership. The term has become strategic partnership now in the program of the CDU, if I'm not wrong. Well, nothing came out of it. Privileged partnership, call it privileged partnership or strategic partnership, it hasn't been defined yet. And I think Angela Merkel knows very well that there's a kind of sensitivity towards this word. It is regarded as an alternative to full membership. And anyway, now we seem to be stuck in an, I will call it an awkward partnership, where none of the partners seem to be committed to. So maybe that's why she didn't feel the need to refer to privileged partnership.
So it's, we say, double it's kaymaklı awkwardness.
Yes.
Rana, how does domestic German politics look from the perspective specifically of this issue, the issue of the product that we might or may not be able to see at the end of the tunnel? Are there changes that are starting to present themselves on the German scene?
At this point, I would differentiate two things. So first of all, we had a very strong debate in Germany going on Turkey turning its back on the West or on the European Union, and the other way around, if the European Union is really committed to get Turkey into the EU. At that point, I would say that the relationship between Turkey and the EU through German glasses always had been characterized through changes. If you look into history, there always had been ups and downs, and we're gonna have a better situation pretty soon, I'm very sure. However, there's one thing that made me a little bit nervous, especially if you look on the stance of the Social Democrats and the Green Party, who had been the strongest, the strongest advocates for the Turkish potential membership. So when Erdogan and Davutoğlu 1 week before had been in Berlin, it was Frank-Walter Steinmeier, the Social Democratic foreign minister, who said that the process need to be kept open. So he was putting an emphasis on the process and not on the potential outcome. And this is a very specific rhetoric you can also observe when you look into the speeches of Green Party members, etc. So this sounds to me that, it is open-ended. Nobody wants to commit to the final goal of membership, exactly. But it is very important to keep up the process. And actually, this is, there are slight differences between the SPD, the Greens, and the CDU on the other hand. So I think we get serious domestic problems in the party coalition of the CDU and the SPD, because the CDU recently leaked its party manifesto for the European Parliament, saying that they reject membership. So then you can ask, where's the point in negotiating, you know? I would say that that at least the tone also changed from a social democratic and green perspective, and nobody wants to commit too much.
And maybe when you go beyond political parties, when it comes to the other major players in Germany, especially industrials and business associations, how does that look?
Well, I would say we have it to do with a serious lack of political will on, but by the way, on both sides, on the sides of Turkish decision makers as well as German decision makers, highlighting the role of civil society, if you ask me. So me working for a private foundation, though all my views are personal at this point. So it is very, very imminent and important to basically improve travel and education opportunities for Turks in countries of the European Union or vice versa. So we need to get people together, and this is the only way to counter this dead end on the political level we can witness right now. However, what I also would like to say at this point is, if you ask me, we have a very interesting situation with Turkey wants to become partially part of the European Union. They want to get into not everything of the EU, but only in some parts and some policy fields. And on the other hand side, we have it to do with the United Kingdom, and they want to get partially out. Mm-hmm. So we have like two countries, Turkey and the United Kingdom, with very similar interests. And this brings me to the point of saying, let's be creative. Let's be creative when it comes to new forms of membership, not partnership. I think, as you said, the term of a privileged partnership is dead. We can delete it out of the vocabulary. But we need new forms of membership, and the European Union always had been a project under construction. And I think we are now at a point where we, need to construct it into
very good
new fields.
Yeah, all right. Thanks. I suppose one of the alternative is not the minister who had taken over Nilgün's bureaucracy, where she used to work, who had at one point suggested that maybe EU member countries could apply for membership to Turkey. That, I suppose, is not one of the alternatives there.
No.
Maybe, Rana, before I turn over to Joshua, very quickly, I know you follow this issue. How do the Turkish community, Turkish-German community, look at these issues in Germany? Would you be able to reflect on that?
Yes and no. So I would say the on the one hand side, I'm in favor of really differentiating those two spheres. On the one hand side, we have it to do with a bilateral, multilateral process of Turkey becoming part of the EU or not, so this is strictly political. On the other hand, we have it to do with peoples on the ground. And so the whole integration debate is mixed with the Turkish EU discourse. Yes, this is true. And on the one hand side, I can understand it. On the other hand side, I'm very hesitant to do it because, to me, if you ask me, we have it to do with two different discourses. The integration discourse in Germany is detached and attached to Turkish European affairs. So, yeah, you see, I'm not too sure how to answer on that. But I mean, coming back to the visits of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, be it in Dusseldorf or in Cologne 2-3 years ago, or now recently in Berlin, and then there were accusations from German politicians saying that, hey, you are basically blocking the integration of German Turks into society. I would say, let's keep it plain and simple. Let's calm down. I mean, like, if you have an ethnic group in a foreign country, I mean, like, it is in the state's interest to also take care of this group, as Germans are also doing abroad with a huge German minor, German heritage people in the United States. So I wouldn't over politicize it that Erdogan from time to time comes to Germany and talks to a Turkish.
But you have to recognize and give him some credit that he didn't on this occasion call assimilation a crime against humanity. So he has clearly mellowed his position on that. A very, very quick additional question. You made this interesting reference to how civil society groups believe that there should be more interaction, more travel between Turks and between Turkey and Germany at the level of especially students, civil society representatives. One important breakthrough that came about last year, towards the very end of the year, was the signing of the readmission agreement and the promise to a roadmap to the visa liberalization for Turkish nationals there. I have a very, very simple, very hopefully a yes and no answer. I have this feeling, and a little bit propaganda, Center for European Policy Studies this morning just published an article of a small essay of mine on this. Will the negotiations make things worse between the EU or Turkey, or will this be an occasion to build bridges? In Turkey, politicians, and the agreement is just being debated before ratification at the parliament right now, they have big, big question marks whether if Turkey deliver its end of the readmission agreement, will the EU actually go ahead and liberalize its visa policies towards Turkish nationals. Let's assume that Turkey does an excellent job on whatever is demanded from them. And the day comes when the European Council has to vote on whether to take Turkey off the blacklist, so-called blacklist. Where would Germany stand?
Well, first of all, I'm no politician, so this is
no,
my
this issue. Is your judgment.
And I would say yes, they would vote for yes.
All right.
However, when would this be is the crucial question to me, because as you said, both sides, they agreed on a process again and not on the outcome. And I think the outcome also has to do with political socialization. So let this voting be in 5 years' time, 8 years' time. I think we have it to do with a completely different Turkish-European agenda at that time. And but for the time being, I would say yes, because you have strong domestic forces in Germany who are pushing in favor of such an agreement, also with regard to the Social Democrats and the Greens, who are strongly in favor.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Rana. Josh, when you were much younger, you were in Ankara, and that was the early 2000s, I think. Those were critical years when Turkey was trying hard to meet the Copenhagen criteria. And if you could go back to those years, and this is where I'd like to address the question that was raised by the organizers. What were the pros and cons of Turkish membership to the European Union, especially from the perspective of the organization for whom you were working there and your boss?
Assuming my former boss at the
Edelman.
State Department.
Yes, Ambassador Eric Edelman.
Everyone in the room is wondering, he can't possibly be that much younger. He looks like he's 18 right
well,
now.
So
that, unfortunately, I'm not blessed with a Turkish gene that gives you the full beard. You know, I think I'd start, Kemal, by saying this. When I first went to Turkey, and my original kind of inspiration for Turkey and all these things is sitting in front of here in terms of the institution of Hüseyin Bajcı. So all of you students who are working on Turkey, you know, find the Turkish professor in the room and kind of be inspired. But I think the real interesting thing was when I went to Turkey for the first time, the real place from which, as an American, you study Turkey was from Europe. It seemed obvious that as an American, obviously you look at Turkey from the perspective of Europe. It's the largest, you know, has the second largest military force in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It's been part of the Western Alliance for over 50 years at that point in time. Now we're talking about 60 years. It seemed obvious that that's where you looked at it from. Now it seems very different. I think, as we've already heard, the discussions of kind of where Turkey is geographically has never shifted. But in our minds, our perceptions of Turkey, it seems to have drifted further and further east, which we can, you know, assign blame or discussion where it came from. But I think at the time, when we were thinking about back in the early 2000s, and this is before the war in Iraq, the real thing seemed to be, this is a great thing for the U.S. It seemed obvious that there was a triangle here, where Turkey sat at the very pinnacle of the top, and the U.S. and the EU were different pillars. The U.S. represented the geostrategic relationship in which the military and defense contractors, Defense Department, kind of controlled the majority of this relationship. Mostly, they would go to the generals in Ankara, they would talk to the Joint Chiefs when it came to these discussions, they would talk to politicians, but it was really about the strategic relationship. The EU was a much more kind of fluid and much more exchange and people-to-people driven. It was much more economically focused. And I think the numbers and the statistics prove that in terms of the lack of a relationship from an economic perspective that we always talk about between the U.S. and Turkey versus the EU. Now, of course, there were some misperceptions at the time as well. It seemed to me that when you looked and polled people in Turkey, and, you know, the majority of Turks at the time were in favor of EU membership, it was as if they had this image that there was a goal, there was a golden path to the EU, that if somehow they could just become an EU member, they could drag themselves from a middle-income country to an upper-middle-income country, just like Ireland, Portugal, Spain, and other countries had done. The shine of the EU is still very bright. The magnetism of the EU is still there. Clearly, sitting where we are now and looking at the trouble that the EU and Greece and Cyprus and other countries of the EU have gone through, the shine is no longer there. Therefore, when our friend and former EU minister makes the comments that he does, I've made similar comments saying, look at the growth rates and looking at the demography. I would much rather be in the position of Turkey as a demographically strong and vibrant young nation versus some of the older economies and some of the areas that are struggling in the European Union. In terms of the future, it seems to me the growth rates of Turkey, which let's not forget that even a couple years ago, Turkey was one of the fastest growing markets in the world. It was being called the China of Europe. It was a lot of points out there. But the interesting point is, whenever as an American we would look at these issues, we took a little bit of distance to this, right? When you had European politicians criticizing the United States for our strong support of the EU membership process of Turkey, they would wag their fingers at us, whether it was President Chirac of France or whether it was somebody who was very pro of Joschka Fischer, saying, this is different. You understand, this is like taking Mexico as the 51st state of the United States. It is not the same as Mexico joining the NAFTA or the North Atlantic Free Trade Agreement. It's a very different relationship. And I think what's interesting today when you look at it is the United States had a very clear policy from the very beginning, whether it was back in Ambassador Edelman's time, under the Bush administration, under the so-called neocons, or under the Obama administration, under Secretary Clinton. They have always been in favor of EU membership. Now, the interesting thing here is the Turks, in many ways, have begun to feel a different difference in the way in which we approach this. I described a triangle earlier. I would say that the war in Iraq in many ways strengthened the EU-Turkish piece of the triangle, and it weakened the U.S. side of things. The U.S. and the administration was frustrated and upset that Turkey said no, even though it was on a technicality that we don't think about as often today when we talk about it. The way the Turks sold this policy to us was to say, well, look, this is the Europeanization, it's the democratization of Turkey. We're doing just what France and Germany have done, therefore you can't really be mad at us. And if you remember, the U.S. response to Turkey was more one of benign neglect than it was of kind of really coming down hard on Turkey in the way we did with Russia, France, and some other players. And this distinction that was made by that administration about new and old Europe was not very helpful because it divided the EU in kind of different partitions, and Turkey in many ways played with this very clearly. And this discussion we've already had about language matters. When you talk about a strategic partnership, that's the language that we've always used in Washington to describe our relationship with Ankara. And so as this kind of strategic partnership morphed into what became known as the model partnership, I have to say mostly because the Turkish side really enjoyed that term more so than the American official policy, and because the U.S. side of things was divided in many ways. You had different perspectives within the administration, and so as a result, we didn't want to offend the other side. And so if you had the State Department with one view on things, the White House another, the Trade Office another, the Department of Defense, you know, D.C. is not as easy as or as simplistic sometimes, nor is Turkey as simplistic as simply saying everything that's happening in Turkey today you can assign to one individual or to one party, although increasingly it seems to be looking more and more that way. And so I think that this kind of blanket U.S. support of EU membership, which began both from a place of saying we share similar values and we want to bring Turkey closer and closer into this transatlantic community of not only of kind of economic issues and these hard security questions, but also of values, was very important. But over time, as that triangle has become more and more lopsided, where now, in many ways, the U.S. and Turkish relationship from a strategic point of view, because of what's happened with the Arab Spring, because of what's happening in Syria, because of these big questions, has become more strong, and yet the EU and Turkish side of things is now on life support. And so rather than having a thriving partnership where we reinforce one another through this trilateral relationship, we've gotten into a situation where one side gets weak, the other side, it's almost become a zero-sum game, which is very unfortunate because that's not the way I think it ever was meant to be, and I think it's not the way that it allows us to have the healthiest relationship. So I think there are many pros and cons. I would argue that there's very few cons of joining the EU from a values perspective in terms of everything that the EU stands for, all the criteria that are the Copenhagen criteria that the Prime Minister and his government have called the Ankara criteria as well, are in Turkey's interest moving forward. The only cons you begin to see are maybe there are some areas in which Turkey wants to have its own sovereignty to act, where it has its own ability to not have to work in the EU structure. And I think particularly the discussions we've already had about the destructive nature of kind of the EU as a supranational force, where a tiny little country like Cyprus can block a country as big and as powerful as Turkey that everybody in the international community needs to thrive. And because of its central geography, we need to be able to have Turkey look both east and west and not simply become schizophrenic where one time it's focusing west, now it's east. We have to have it at the same time. You referenced the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was always a European empire. It was always a part of that. You know, from the gates of Vienna all the way down to Mecca and other areas, you can't simply say that, oh, well, Turkey's now become a Middle Eastern power. It's a Middle Eastern regional power. It is both European and Middle Eastern. And acknowledging that and working in that structure and not having its partners try to make it an either-or question is particularly important, I think, in this area.
Well, great, Josh. Very lively reflection on the EU, Turkey, and the U.S. triangle. But I do have two additional very quick questions, somewhat inspired by Rana's remarks. As I listened to you and the way you laid out this triangular relationship, I felt, on the basis of what Rana said, especially in terms of civil society in Germany, I felt suddenly it seemed like what has been missing on the U.S. angle is that Turkey's EU membership saga has been an issue for the State Department, maybe a little bit for the Congress, but not so much for civil society as well as the business world. What do we make of it? But Rana also made references to the challenge of the United Kingdom and what might follow if the outcome of the referendum, and then there's the Scotland's referendum challenge there. Also, given that for the U.S., European integration was always a very important project. This is my reading of history, and frankly, I belong to the group of people who believe that if Dean Acheson wasn't around and if U.S. State Department and the White House was not behind that project in the late 40s and early 50s, maybe we wouldn't be where we are. Where does this leave the United States in terms of that perspective? Also in the light of what's in many ways going on in Ukraine. I realize I've touched upon many issues there, but Ambassador, please, I would eventually like to hear your reflections on that last point. Very quickly, Josh.
Yep.
And shortly.
That would be very difficult with the,
Don't be too Turkish.
I will try not to be, but it's difficult being Turkish in spirit in many ways. You know, I think what's interesting about the question that you pose is you get at the heart of the U.S.-Turkish relationship. It's something that anybody that's a friend of Turkey can't help but notice, which is that there is, you know, when you look at the number of exchange students, Turkey is the number one sender of students to the United States of all of Europe, which is astonishing in many ways. When you think about Britain and Germany, et cetera, there's over 11,000 Turks at this point in time studying in the United States. The number from the U.S. to Turkey is abysmal. I mean, we're talking very... When I went to Turkey for the first time, I could probably count on one hand, and, you know, the shock that people would have of saying, why are you learning Turkish? Why do you even bother? You speak English, the global language. And to say learning Turkish is important because to be able to do business, to be able to think about the role that Turkey has. So I think it has to grow beyond the geostrategic. It has to grow beyond. It has to really become inculcated into the populations and the civil society in a way I think you see in Germany, not necessarily organically, I would point out, right? The German workers that are there of Turkish origin were not necessarily going there simply because they loved Germany. They went there because there was jobs, there was money, there was things to be done. That's what then created that web that connected the two. We don't have that same organic connection between the U.S. and Turkey, even though probably if all the countries in the world I were to point at and say, of all the troubles that we have around the world, what country could help us if they were on the same path with us? Turkey would be the single country I would point out. I would simply kind of finish my reflection, since I know I want to hear from Ambassador Wilson on these points, who's far more expert than I am on these things, is when we think about the EU and Turkish, what's most painful, we've used these different analogies. One of the things that's most painful is it's like watching a couple that once was in great love, but they never quite were able to seal the deal and get married. So now they're engaged, and they think they're leading towards a path, but they both have fallen out of love with each other. So at a certain point in time, you have to ask him as a friend, are you going to get back together? Are you going to rekindle that love? Do you need to go back on a honeymoon somewhere? Or are you going to go your separate ways and be good friends? Because otherwise, if you're jilted lovers towards the future, that leaves us with a real problem that I don't think the United States or any other country can solve if the EU and Turkey are not on the same path. It doesn't mean that they agree on everything. And I think in the same way, this is a unique and historic relationship that has to be fostered. And I think whatever the U.S. can do, both from a civil society perspective and the less we can rely on the government-to-government relations, the better this relationship will look in the future.
All right, Josh. Thanks. I think our prime minister likes to remind us that this engagement has been going on for too long and the two sides are aging. If the Ankara agreement is taken as a reference point, But Ambassador, let's look at that broader tableau, if you the geostrategic strategic picture there. Especially with what's happening in Ukraine, and especially also what we read in the papers that it's not just Ukraine, but Moldova and Georgia may also be soon in the pipeline as far as Putin's efforts to reinstate the what sometimes we used to call the Russia's near abroad, influence over near abroad. And I frankly can't help but go back to the 40s, late 40s and 50s, and remind myself of the decision makers, policy makers, American decision makers, policy makers of the time, and the way in which they approached to the case of Turkey and the way in which they played that critical role in anchoring Turkey in the transatlantic community. Are we going through a similar period right now, and what are the dynamics that are driving it, and where does the U.S. stand? I realize Assistant Secretary Nuland was in Ukraine and overlooked the fact that these days we are listened in all senses of the word. Where does Turkey fit in there, in that changing and very nebulous picture there?
Well, thank you, Kamal. There are a lot of questions wrapped up in that, and thinking about how to add value after everything that others have said here on your analogy of a couple in love. It may be a couple who are acquainted, maybe well acquainted, who have an arranged marriage that the arrangers are not sure how comfortable they are with with how things work out. There's something we might play with there analytically. Let me sort of deal with your questions in this manner. Kemal. I think back to what I arrived to Turkey to in late 2005. I essentially served this more or less the second Bush administration in Ankara. This was a couple of months after the formal opening of Turkey-EU negotiations in, I believe, in October 2005. And throughout certainly the first couple of years of my time there, until it was clear that the opening of negotiations was a little bit stillborn, you had a very, as an American looking at Turkey and looking at how the EU comported itself, you had a very interesting set of things going on. For an American, because of the history of U.S.-Turkish relations, because of Turkey's rather extensive nationalistic view that Turks don't like to be told by others what to do, in U.S.-Turkish relations, our conversation about internal Turkish developments was always rather limited. And usually, very much behind closed doors and a quiet conversation. Whereas the EU, because of the opening of the negotiation process, was able to, and to some extent was even welcomed in taking up issues in Turkey's internal developments and internal political and economic reform process that the rest of us couldn't do. It was something that's very interesting and very different. The EU had credibility on these issues because it had a framework for the negotiations, the acquis, and all of the stuff that goes along with that. It had, if not a clearly defined endpoint, a defined enough endpoint that it was able to act in useful and constructive ways. That begins to unravel by 2007, certainly by 2008. As chapter after chapter after chapter gets blocked, and Turkish resentment over that blockage and over what produced it, over what was seen as moving goalposts, sort of then sets in, and you have a period, a long period, where it seemed like pretty much every day, senior Turkish officials woke up in the morning wondering how they could bash and complain about the EU today, which then had a corrosive effect on public attitudes. Second point, you look back now at how things have evolved. Neither Turkey nor the European Union were static. You know, there was a certain model at the beginning. The EU has got this acquis, and it's going to move forward, and Turkey is where it is, and it's going to move forward. But the goalpost did change. A reference was made earlier to the increased importance to separation of powers and legal judicial issues that take shape in connection with disappointments regarding several of the Balkan countries. So the EU is changing and evolving in terms of its criteria. The EU is changing and evolving because of the 2008-09 financial crisis. Its attitudes towards expansion are changing. I was at a session a couple of years ago where one of the participants remarked that that EU enlargement may be off for a generation because of the difficulties there. So the EU is changing in some important ways. And Turkey, I think, is also changing, and a couple of the previous speakers remarked on the explosive, dramatic economic growth in Turkey that changes the nature of the economy that the EU would be taking in, largely in good ways, but certainly it's a much bigger swallow, and also changes in the attitudes that Turkey brings. Turkey, always a proud country, but now unusually successful, or in a long period of unusual political success. Turkey in 2008, 9, 10, 11, more successful as a country, spoken of broadly, than probably at any time in a couple of hundred years. And that too affects these negotiations in ways that I think we don't understand. Third comment, throughout this period, and I would plead guilty myself in this respect, there's a certain willful disregard of how hard these negotiations were going to be, and not just the negotiations are probably the easy part, how hard the process would be. The issue of Mexico as a 51st state. This is a big deal. It's different from all of the countries that came before. This disparity of size, a willful disregard of extensive anti-Turkish sentiment all over Europe, or at least relatively low levels of public support for Turkish accession to the European Union in many, if not most, EU countries. And of course, willful disregard of the counterpart to that, which is we could politely define it as Turkish nationalism. We could less politely define it as anti-European sentiment or anti-Western sentiment in Turkey. And the grinding of the gears that would produce, the cultural issues that go along with this, Islam and Christendom is not exactly the right way to think about it, but it is there, and it is reflected in the way people think about it. And so, you know, a sort of a willful disregard of these and other problems, if we can work through some of the specifics, time will pass and things will come out okay in the end. And I think the changing nature of Turkey, the changes in the European Union now make these and other difficulties harder than they used to be. Fast forward, and I'll wrap close with this, fast forward to the last 5 or 6 months. One of the reasons why, go back to what you said, Kamal, about Dean Acheson and others bringing Turkey into the Western alliance, partly it was a view Turkey is a bulwark, a blockade, something that will hold back Soviet expansion into the Middle East, and it's pure geopolitics almost in a military defense and security sense. But it was also a view that the West had a stake in how Turkey would evolve and how it would develop. So as turmoil really starts, instability starts to set into contemporary Turkey again, that's what Gezi Park is. That's what the current events going on in Turkey are. It is a kind of instability we have not seen in Turkey for over a decade. A realization in Europe that Europe has a stake in that outcome. It confused by what it sees in Turkey, particularly with respect to rule of law-related issues. It doesn't like what it sees, by and large. These developments seem to run counter to European values. Some of the language the Turkish leaders, in particular the prime minister, use also look to Europeans way out of kilter with the vision of Turkey and of broader Europe that EU leaders would like to see. So we have a stake in this. We need to get these negotiations back on track so that we have leverage to work on some of these issues. Get back to where the EU was in terms of its leverage in 2003, 4, 5, 6, maybe even in 2007 in trying to work on some of the concrete issues. The Obama administration, no less than the Bush administration, which was criticized perhaps rightly for being very strong and strident in support of the EU, the Obama administration has, in my perception, become quite passive on these matters, on matters related to Turkey's EU accession. It hardly talks about this at all. And it's not that Washington is disinterested, and I'm certainly not saying this is necessarily a good thing. It just is. It is what it is. The priorities in U.S.-Turkish relations have been so overwhelmed by Syria, to some extent by Iraq-related issues, by the sort of external agenda that we always had with Turkey, and that is in a sense reflected for the EU in the idea of privileged partnership or strategic partnership, our common interests, all those other things. It's not bilateral; it's elsewhere. Anyway, that's been the focus of the Obama administration. I think to the detriment of Turkey and the European Union and the way that the two interact with one another, and I think if it becomes possible really to put the EU-Turkey process back on track once Turkey gets out of its current period of of internal turmoil, and particularly works through these elections and deals with their consequences, as you move to that period, the United States can and will take up a more active role, both on NATO-related issues, on Turkey-EU issues, and how those pieces relate to one another.
Mm-hmm. In the impression, thanks, Ambassador. I feel somewhat not so exciting picture is emerging about Turkey's relations with the European Union. Ambassador, you made references to the negotiations being stillborn already in 2005-2006. And Nilgün made references to the difficulties that Turkey faces in getting new chapters open. Mighty challenges seem to sit there. Any suggestions on where we could go from here? Is there a project in the horizon that that we could latch on to ensure that Turkey remains a vibrant member of the transatlantic community? Very briefly, Ambassador, and then Rana will. Yeah. And I will turn. I'm trying to make sure we have 30 minutes for questions and answers.
Well, one answer I would give, the title of this session, Endless Negotiations,
yes.
Right now that may not be a bad objective, mm-hmm. that the EU-Turkey effort not break down, or it is broken down, but that it not be called off, terminated. That's not a bad objective for the next 16 months or so, or anyway, until after the parliamentary election in Turkey, 2015 or whenever it is, if it comes earlier, that things don't totally fall apart. I don't really see a whole lot of prospects for a dramatic change in the way the picture looks. And if worse things can be avoided, I think that's a fine thing. Once Turkey gets past that, and of course to some extent depending on how it gets through the next 16 months and what kind of government emerges out the other end, a lot can be accomplished in the negotiations, the mechanics of those negotiations. You're still not dealing with some of the underlying difficulties, maybe at all, but you can restore, it is possible, should be possible, to restore a little bit of a sense of momentum and get conversations going on some of the specifics, and ideally a internal reform process gets going in Turkey. Those are the fundamental things that really actually are required here to get the literal negotiations back on track. You mentioned in your opening remarks TTIP. The economic side may provide some opportunities, again, once you get past the current political cycle, to reconcile Turkey with what the United States and the European Union are negotiating may conclude in the course of the next couple of years, although I'm a little dubious about that. Turkey is going to need to be reconciled with that somehow. The fact of Turkey's strategic and military alliance with Europe and the United States on the one hand needs to be matched by on the economic side. And I think there's a lot that can be done in that area that doesn't get at nationalist hot buttons in Turkey, that doesn't have to deal with issues of anti-Turkish sentiment in Europe or opposition among Turkish publics to accession. There's wider scope for opportunity. The problem will be that can quickly become a substitute for Turkey's EU accession. And so how that gets played it'll be very hard and complicated.
Yeah. Thanks, Ambassador. I actually feel that I have achieved my strategic goal for this particular panel and got TTIP into the picture there. Thanks, Ambassador. I know, Rana, you'd like to make a very brief remark.
Exactly. So. Yeah, you seem to be a bit dim and pessimistic for the future prospect of Turkish relations. I just want to mention three things. First of all, if we look on the strategic interests, we still have it to do with a huge commonality of interest between Turkey and the European Union, be it in security affairs, be it in economic affairs. So both partners cannot afford to really move into two different directions. Secondly, if you look back in history, most of the disagreements or the atmospheric turbulences refer to the person and to the character of Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And just imagine a Turkey in future without this prime minister and with another prime minister. Since last summer, this option isn't too unrealistic, I think. And thirdly, I believe the parameters for Turkish EU affairs are not laid in Turkey, but in the European Union when it comes, first of all, to the question in what kind of EU we want to live. So the euro crisis is not solved yet. We can talk about a banking union. We can talk about lots of other instruments. How to fix it? How to fix the problem? However, we seriously need to think the European Union in complete other terms, mm-hmm. In order to make it ready for future challenges. And last but not least, I'm also very curious when it regards to the new High Representative for Foreign Affairs. Kashton won't make it for a second term, so maybe we're going to have also another common ground for Turkish-EU partnership.
Okay. Well, thanks for those final remarks there, Rana. The third one, I think it's an interesting one, but the other side of that medallion is also Turkey deciding on what kind of a Turkey it wants to be. I think we were very excited in 2003, 2004, Hüseyin, Nilgün, and others, because we really thought that Turkey was at the verge of becoming exactly the opposite of what Nilgün said, a very boring place, you know, liberal democracy with rule of law ticking over, somewhat becoming like a Switzerland maybe. But in the meantime, especially since the time you've made references to, we're fast drifting away from that. And as much as I think it's critical, I agree, what the EU wants to become in the future is important. I think what we want to become is very important there. And Rana, I think I agree with you that personality factor may well be important there. Now I'd like to turn to you and take some questions, remarks. Suat Kınıklıoğlu is a former MP for AKP, but on the way to Damascus, as the expression goes, he's seen the light. And
give him a second chance.
Yes.
Thank you, Kemal. Always entertaining. Thank you. My question is to Ross. Very simple. Up to the last maybe 6-7 years ago, when you would come to the city, Turkey would be discussed as a European country. Today, I get the feeling many people in this city see Turkey as a Middle Eastern country. Would you agree? And if so, why is that way?
I was hoping to take a few questions, but I think this is a critical question. So, Ambassador, please.
Not well, thank you. is Turkey seen as a European country or as a Middle Eastern country? My honest answer is yes. It's both. It is, on any given day, it may be viewed this way, it may be viewed that way. Syria has overwhelmed the U.S.-Turkish relationship over the course of the last 2 years. I think it dominates the way and also Iraq, which has been pivotal for a decade. I think these issues dominate the political discourse that we have with Turkey, that the State Department has, that the Defense Department has. And to that extent, sure, Turkey is a Middle Eastern country, and it is seen as one. It is integrally involved in and and a factor for us as we think about Syria, as we think about Iraq, as we think about Iran. And there's you can't, there's no changing that. Frankly speaking, I think a second area in which Turkey may today be viewed as somewhat less European is on the domestic side. The pictures that one sees are less European. They look less Turkish, for that matter, or less Turkish that we've thought of the country over the course of the last number of years. But the heart of the relationship is remains, or an important heart of the relationship remains NATO. The parts of the U.S. government that deal with Turkey on a day-to-day basis are the people that are responsible for Europe, whether it's at the State Department or the Pentagon or the NSC or anywhere else. And while there is now a whole kind of a conversation with American policymakers who are responsible for the Middle East that did not exist when I served there and did not fundamentally exist years before that, that's a good thing, but I think it comes back to your, you know, it ends up in the way we deal with Turkey, the agenda is so dominated, there's no other way really to kind of think about it. Mm. That's not a great answer, but...
No. Thanks, Ambassador. I really was touched or overwhelmed with your reference, less Turkish than the way we'd known it. And let me share a tiny little anecdote that enveloped me with this feeling in Ankara, where I stayed at the Başkent Öğretmenevi. You know, being a professor, I'm attached to this Öğretmenevi institution in Turkey. Yeah. Öğretmenevi are teachers' guest houses. And it's not only cheap, but it's also a basic, nice, clean place. And after the stressful interviews I had, I wanted to go and exercise in the spor salonu, the fitness center. I walked up to the reception, and I said, I think you have a fitness center. I've checked it. It looks closed. But can I just go in, turn on the lights, and do whatever I'd like to do? And the lady behind the counter turned around and said, oh, no, you can't go in there. There's a person, official, running the place, and he decides when men and then women can go in there separately. And that, I must say, really shocked me out of my shoes. And in response, I kind of, a few words came out of my mouth saying, you know, 19 Mayıs, I don't know how familiar you are with this. I said, but for 19 Mayıs, we were always boys and girls in the stadiums, that we never got segregated. But that's what you made me remind me of, and I think the question comes back again to us, to
yeah.
Turks. And Suad, I think you think along those lines that we need to sort this out, bearing again in mind that the Ottoman Empire, at the end of the day, was actually a European empire. We have we still have a good 20 minutes. Helen, please. And we were on the same campus back in the
yes.
early 70s.
Too long ago, too.
Yes, we were much
imagine.
Older than Joshua then.
I have a question. It's mostly for Ambassador Wilson, but it's for anyone, about TTIP. If the United States and Europe can get over GMOs and the NSA affair and the many difficulties involved in these discussions, obviously it's a very, very good thing. And it strikes me, you mentioned NATO, it strikes me that TTIP for Turkey in terms of transatlantic relationship and keeping Turkey in the transatlantic family of engagement, that this would be immensely important. What are the real, assuming we and Europeans of the EU get over this, what are the, because I always include Turkey as European, what are the real prospects for this? I mean, how do Turks feel about it? How are they looking at it? Because that would be the economic depth. Mm.
Thanks.
Did you want to add something to? Okay.
Yeah, thanks, Ellen. But this was not a planted question. We didn't conspire about this or at our campus, Boğaziçi. Ambassador, allow me to take maybe two more questions so that I can then turn to each member of the panelists. Yes, please.
Hello, I'm Mara Nekstrom, and I'm a participant in American University's Washington Semester Program. And I'm directing this question to anyone on the panel. What are your insights on Turkey's role in Central Asia, especially compared to other actors in the region vying for influence? And that's harking back to the discussion on Russia and the near abroad earlier in the conversation. And then given that, what are some of the implications for EU-Turkey relationships regarding Central Asia?
Thank you. Let me take one more question.
Hi, my name is Tina Amundsen. I'm also in the Washington Semester Program, and this is a question for Rana. You said the EU must maybe change the way it's approached for the future and explore new types of memberships. So what kind of memberships will maybe be the outcome for Turkey?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Let me start with Rana right next door, and then we'll work our way through the panel.
Reacting to your question, so I would say, first of all, we need to have a certain sense for creativity. This is imminent. We really need to think out of the box, and the membership talks and the accession process, as we had witnessed it with regard to the 10 Middle and Central and Eastern European countries in 2004, this won't happen again in future. And I think all Turkish decision makers need to consider that, as well as all European decision makers. And referring to your question now, I think, in 2004, we had it to do with a Big Bang accession, you know? So 10 countries entered the European Union, adopting fully the whole acquis communautaire with all 33 or 34 chapters at that time. And one potential alternative or new kind of membership could be, referring to a concept of a German political scientist, Kemal Karakas, in Frankfurt, of a so-called, how did he call it, like the partial membership. So saying that a country doesn't necessarily need to adopt everything, but in certain policy fields it might make sense to integrate a country fully fledged, also with regard to the veto, with the decision-making procedures, etc., pp. So the advantage of such a concept with, compared to privileged partnership or whatever, would be that you wouldn't change the final goal of full membership. One day in future, you would say, one day in future, Turkey shall become a fully fledged part of the European Union.
The term was gradual membership.
Gradual membership. But on the way to this final goal, we need to be creative, and then it might make sense to integrate you with regard to energy politics, with regard to foreign politics or trade politics, whatever. So this might be one concept.
Yeah. Very interesting. Nilgün?
I'd like to say a few things about this new forms of membership, then I'll say a few things about Turkey and Tizip. Some Turkish scholars, leading Turkish scholars, including Kemal Derviş, also supported this view that with the measures to deal with euro crisis, a new a multi-tier or multi-speed Europe is emerging. So that might enable new and flexible forms of membership that would facilitate Turkey's membership in the EU as well. I can understand that given the current state of affairs between Turkey and the EU, this is a very attractive and comfortable way of looking things. But I have some reservations. First, I think a high-level EU, like a high-level EU official said, you have to be in first to be out, like UK. And secondly, who will choose, because Turkey is inclined to choose those areas like energy, transport, internal market, common foreign and security policy. Who would choose in which policies Turkey will participate in, EU or Turkey? And the crucial thing is, will Turkey be able to participate in the decision-making mechanisms of the policies that it has to adopt? Because now what we suffer in customs union, we have to adopt and implement the common common external trade policy of the EU, but in the design of it, we even don't have an observer status. That's what we suffer in TTIP as well. There's an asymmetry in our relations. Well, when European Union negotiates a free trade agreement with a third party, Turkey is not included in those negotiations. And it takes at least some time for Turkey to have the same free trade agreement with that third country. So the concrete result is that Turkey's goods cannot be exported to those countries' soil without being subject to any customs duties. But vice versa, those countries' goods can be imported to Turkey without being subject to any customs duties. Well, regarding TTIP, we are in the same position. And TTIP is not a free trade agreement. It's new international, it's a kind of new international economic system. And if Turkey is not included in such a system, Turkey will be left out of the cold. I think customs union would be futile after TTIP is concluded between EU and US. I can understand to a certain point that Turkey cannot be included in the negotiations, but a well-designed parallel structure for the negotiations can be designed for Turkey. That's what I think. That's all I wanted to say.
Thanks.
And sorry. Inclusion of Turkey to TTIP, in a way, with a parallel structure, is not only important for economic matters. It is very important for democracy and economic governance and rule of law.
Yeah. Actually, what fascinates me is that I'm beginning to receive email messages from various business associations in Turkey, and including like Malatya İş Adamları Derneği, Malatyalılar İş Adamı. Malatya is a town, central Anatolian town, who started to do quite well as an Anatolian tiger economically. So more and more business associations are getting in touch with me to see if I could come and talk about TTIP. And my feeling from the conversation I've had is that this is primarily driven by economic considerations, but as important as that is their sense that TTIP represents rule of law, that their investments will be protected there. Mm-hmm. Josh, there were some interesting questions about Central Asia. I'd like you to take up those. Thank you.
Let me just tie it. Malatya is also famous for their apricots. And so if you want to have good apricots, you need to include Malatya in your free trade agreement. When you think about kind of that type of discussion that Kamal just mentioned, the kind of Central Anatolian tigers, the so-called groups in the middle that had never been a part of Turkey's major economic success, when they were unleashed by forces that go before this government, sometimes we forget that what's happened in the last decade, we give credit for the current government. But things happened afterwards. And I think Central Asia is a good place here. There's going to be a whole panel in the last part of the afternoon about external affairs, so I'm not going to go too far into it. Simply to say that Central Asia, Africa, other areas, is really interesting to look at because the difference to which civil society have been the first movers here versus the government is particularly important, right? The hyperactive Turkish foreign minister, who's a professor as well, and everyone knows in this room, likes to point out the number of embassies that he's opened in his tenure. And the majority of these embassies are being opened in places like Africa, Latin America, Central Asia, places that traditionally you wouldn't have thought Turkey would have a big role. And the interesting thing about Central Asia is, you know, there is a clear role for Turkey here, right? This is the Turkic world, so to speak. And in Washington, there's always been a big gap in that part of the world. We talk about the Middle East, we talk about, you know, Europe. We never talk about Central Asia because it's either Russian area or it's, you know, Iran's, etc. Turkey has always been the most obvious choice from a United States point of view, but because of the 1990s, in which kind of the big brother perspective, in which Turkey did not get as much as it could have out of that relationship because the United States had a lot of other things on its plate, it's coming back into vogue now. And the question really is, with what's happening internally in Turkey with the domestic questions that we've all been discussing, the very entities that were out there, both construction workers, hospitals, schools, all of it, are now at war with the government that helped promote them to begin with. They, in some ways, forced Turkish foreign policy to be responsive to their engagement in Central Asia, Africa, etc., to open these embassies. Now what happens when those two factions are against each other? And how do you continue a state policy that was built on civil society and these business exchanges that Kamal talks about? And I think that's where it comes full circle to TTIP. And I think one of the more important things to think about from a DC perspective is TTIP TTIP is not happening in a vacuum. This administration has not proposed just TTIP, the largest free trade agreement. It's proposed the TPP, right? Trans-Pacific Partnership. So you're talking about two of the largest free trade agreements in the world. And so while I understand the Turkish perspective, which is you cannot ignore us, I think from an American domestic point of view, there is a real difficulty here in even getting TTIP, which should be the easiest one. There's not very controversial points here. I mean, it should be easy, but when you have to deal with French wines and cheeses and all that stuff and all the details, putting Turkey in there is a whole other can of worms for everyone included. Now, I think you need to be thinking about it. I think behind the scenes, the administration needs to be doing a very clear-headed job of thinking through this. But from a public point of view, it seems unlikely to me that tomorrow the administration will say, oh, you know what, we'll give Turkey status with TTIP. It's not going to happen. Domestically, it's not possible. And so, you know, we can turn to Ambassador Wilson to hear about TTIP.
Yeah. Ambassador.
TTIP is one of those subjects where the politics all work, and the economic and the business parts are either don't or are a whole lot more complicated. The political case, the strategic case for including Turkey in TTIP is obvious. TTIP is the economic counterpart to NATO.
Exactly.
If we want to anchor Turkey in the West and keep it anchored in the West, we need to somehow reconcile Turkey with this. On the other hand, we want Turkey to go east to become, for Suat, a Middle Eastern country, here's a fine way to do it. Exclude Turkey. Make Turkey pay the price of that TTIP negotiation in terms of duty-free access for American goods and receive none of the benefits. Politically, the dynamics are compelling. It's a very compelling case. The economic side is a lot less so. TTIP is not exactly a free trade agreement, in part because of the similarity of the American and European economies, and in general, at least, the way in which we regulate one another. Turkey is a whole different thing. The manner in which the negotiations take place. We negotiate with the EU. We have a negotiating partner. Turkey has no obvious place in those negotiations, neither for the United States nor for the European Union. That's a big complicator. The negotiations will produce a whole set of commitments that are not political in nature, that are related to economics, that are related to business conditions, the regulatory regime, the services sector, IPR, competition, policy, labor, environment. Turkey, it is extremely difficult to imagine that Turkey could sign on to the kinds of commitments that the European Union and the United States will be able to make. So for Washington and for Brussels, the net effect of making Turkey a quote-unquote full-fledged participant in these negotiations is that they will end up being useless because the kind of accord that will result will in no way resemble the high ambition and generally speaking, attainable result that the United States and the EU can negotiate. It'll be some lesser version that Turkey is both politically and maybe more importantly economically prepared to undertake. There are two alternatives then. One is what's referred to as docking, where Turkey has some opportunity later to sign on to those commitments, to the US-EU commitments reflected in TTIP. I, as a practical matter, I'm not really too sure how that works. And it certainly doesn't deal with the short to medium term political problem. The other is, which is less difficult, although still extremely hard, is to achieve a three-way FTA, if you will, indirectly. Turkey already has a customs union with the EU. The United States will get one with the EU as a result of TTIP. So there's the missing piece is the U.S.-Turkey piece, the possibility of a free trade agreement has been discussed from time to time in the past. Also really, really hard because what Washington will require is a whole lot of things that Turkey will find it very difficult very difficult to do. But I think that's a more fertile road to go down. Turkey can work on building the case for a bilateral FTA by addressing longstanding concerns of American companies in Turkey, and by undertaking the kinds of reforms that our other FTA partners have had to do as part of the process of getting prepared.
Thanks, Ambassador. I think there's one last very quick question. We're just about to run out of time. Please.
Mike Masetic, PBS Online NewsHour. You all have politely and glancingly referred to the massive problems, economic and political, facing the EU. European elections coming up next year. What happens to even the slimmest prospect of advancing the Turkish negotiations if you end up with the parliamentary elections and other elections in Europe that show very clearly the rise of nationalistic anti-immigrant sentiment in Europe to the point that even anti-immigrant parties may dominate the European Parliament?
We've run out of time. Why don't I ask two of you to volunteer the answer?
I would just briefly comment on that. So I wouldn't overestimate the role of the European parliamentary elections for the outcome and the current state of affairs of the Turkish-EU negotiations, as those are negotiated by the European Commission first. Secondly, what I just recently found out, and I was pretty shocked about that, that the AKP basically cancelled its observer status in the European People's Party, the parliamentary group of the European Conservatives, and entered the bloc of the Eurosceptics and exactly those you were talking about.
Yeah.
And
I didn't know that.
So maybe about this, just like a brief remark on that.
Yeah. Who would like to volunteer? Maybe
say a sentence.
Okay.
I agree with Rana that European Parliament doesn't have too much role in the negotiations. Finally, of course, when Turkey, if ever, is to become a member, we need the European Parliament's approval. But I don't think, the negotiations are really stalling. I don't think they can get worse for the moment. And the reason AKP gives for being a part of this anti-EU alliance of conservative reformist party, I don't remember it exactly, but the excuse of AKP is that it hasn't been granted a full member status in the European People's Party. I mean, I don't agree with it. I don't buy, but that's why they became a part of this alliance in which they were given a full membership status.
I wouldn't want to appear like a typical Turk anti-American. So, Josh, Ambassador, if you have any very quick
response. I was fully expecting him to finish that by saying in Turkey, but when he said Europe, it was kind of like, you know, that's a good thing in many ways. I'd much rather talk about European parliamentary malaise, because I think what's interesting about it is the Euroscepticism. I would dispute one thing, and maybe I will politely disagree with my professor here. I think things can get worse. I think there's a possibility in which Turkey, particularly with what Ross was talking about in terms of this Turkish nationalism that he described politely, but you could also take it to the next level, where some people have become downright arrogant in some ways and say, what do we need it for anyways? We're going to go off and we have our own Norwegian path, etc. But Norway was offered it, right? You have to first get there. And I think I liked your idea of saying you have to be inside to become an outsider first. And so this idea that Turkey should be treated the same as the UK is very difficult. And so I think it could get a lot worse, particularly if domestic politics in both Europe and Turkey go in a very nationalistic direction where there's incentives to attack the other.
No one can dare in Turkey to pull the plug, because we need international prestige. And for international prestige, we need EU accession perspective hanging somewhere over there. That's my...
Inshallah.
Ambassador?
I'd only repeat my remark earlier. Neither Turkey nor the European Union are static. There's things changing. And they... Those changes do offer opportunities to both sides in some respects. If we thought about it, we could identify some. They also clearly entail some additional risks and complications that make Turkish-EU relations harder and the prospects for Turkey's accession even more complicated than they are now.
All right. Well, thanks to the panel. I think they did a great job and they deserve a strong round of applause.